from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll take a look at the diverse musical offerings presented by Northwood Christian Church.
I'll get a preview of a new musical based on The Scarlet Letter.
I'll find out about the Butler Creates art exhibit at Clues Hall. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. On the southwest end of Broad Ripple, Northwood Christian Church boasts a music series that is noted for the diversity of its offerings, which include the musical You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Rob Leffler dropped by to tell Sharon more about the series and the musical about Snoopy, Lucy, Linus, and friends.
Okay, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Most people are familiar with the ridiculously long-running comic strip, but some people might not be familiar with the musical. Do you know how the musical got inspired, or the story behind it?
Well, they obviously based it on the Peanuts comic strip, and Clark M. Gesner came up with the concept of setting it to music, and the original actors actually took a big part in developing the script for the original production.
Really?
And
that's a treat.
Yes, it is a treat. It was probably a big treat for the actors in that musical. And then more recently, they did a revival of the musical, which Kristen Chenoweth was in, and they actually rewrote one of the roles for her.
Was she Lucy?
No, she was Sally.
Sally, okay.
Yes, she was Sally. In the original production, they had a role called Patty, and people just assumed that that was Peppermint Patty, but it wasn't. It was an older character in the Peanuts comic that was just Patty. And when they did the revival, they rewrote a few of the songs for Kristen Chenoweth and added the role of Sally and took away Patty.
So in most productions, including yours, these children are played by grown-ups.
Yes. In fact, if you do some research on the show, they talk about the fact that a lot of times the characters don't even look like the original characters do. Obviously, Charlie Brown will have a yellow shirt with his black zigzag and some of the more familiar things from the comic strip, but they had a variety of ethnic backgrounds in the revival. And once you get into the show, it's such a familiar piece and such a familiar cartoon that the aspects of the actors that are not like the original cartoon just sort of fade away.
It goes away. You don't worry about it.
Right. Yeah. You don't worry about it.
Do you remember your first exposure? Did you get to see the revival?
No, I didn't. I think my first exposure actually was through a friend. He said, oh, this would be a great show for your church to do, because we're always looking for something to do as part of the recital series. We always started with some sort of theater. And because of the appeal to children and adults, we thought this would be a great piece to do. And so then I listened to the soundtrack and just fell in love with it. It's got some great music.
And, you know, it is a church setting. It is a script that allows for the opportunity to have conversations, because there are some lessons learned and about friendship and supporting one another and not pulling the football out from the guy who's trying to kick it.
Definitely.
This current music series is just about 3 years old, right?
Yes, this is our third year of having a recital series at Northwood Christian Church.
And you and another person started this 3 years ago?
Yes, actually Jack Fox runs the recital series. He's the minister of music at Northwood. And he approached me about doing or being in charge of the theatrical end of the recital or performance series, whatever you want to call it.
What's your theater background? Where did you get into theater?
I started in community theater in Indianapolis when I graduated from college. I did theater all through high school and performed in college. I went to Butler University here in town. Actually, I was a pharmacy major and a music major. but
interesting
have
combination.
Always had a passion for music and theater.
I'm sorry, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around all of the study required for either of those fields, let alone combining them.
Yeah, there weren't too many classes
that corresponded.
You didn't
have much of a social life, did you? No, not a lot of overlap there.
No, not too
much. I guess you could sing the periodic tables.
Maybe.
How do you go about your casting process? Is your congregation big enough that you have a lot of choices when you're casting a production?
Actually,
like this?
We have gone outside of the church to involve people in the community in the series. I'm the only person that's actually, well, I'm not in the show this year. I've been in the show other years.
But you're directing.
But I'm directing it this year. And none of the characters or the cast members are actually members of the church. They're people that have done theater in New York, people that have done theater here in Indianapolis. Most of them, people that I've met through doing theater and have talked to about auditioning. We did have a small set of auditions and gathered a terrific cast through that process.
That's great. Will you do this with a music track or with a piano or synthesizer?
We'll have live music, yes. We'll have piano and drums, and we'll probably add a couple of other instruments to the process.
How long is your rehearsal process? This is pretty ambitious.
Well, it is ambitious, and by carefully choosing who we've put in the show, we've set out a rehearsal process of about 5 weeks, but we're only rehearsing about three times a week.
Wow.
So... But no, this show's coming together beautifully.
No pressure or anything. As folks are hearing our conversation, the show is up. But we're having this conversation a couple of weeks earlier, and you know, I can feel the here's what we have to take out to the woodshed next. You can see the thought balloon over your head. For people who aren't familiar with the music, is there what would you compare this style of music to? Is there another musical you might compare it to? So if somebody isn't familiar with You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, they might say, well, if you like this, you might like this.
Usually I'm really good at that kind of question, but like nothing springs to mind. It's a more traditional style of music. It's not necessarily Rodgers and Hammerstein, but it's definitely not.
It's not a Sondheim-esque either.
It's not Sondheim or any of the, you know, Rent or something like that.
Yeah.
It's just a sort of a style of music that just really appeals to all people.
Yeah, and stay tuned because we're going to drop a little sample in here, and listeners, so stay tuned. You take a very big turn for your November offering, which is called Renati on November 7th, and it is billed as a multimedia concert. What do you mean by that?
Yes, there is going to be a brass quartet that is going to be joined by the pipe organ at Northwood Christian Church, and then they will also have images displayed, projected on a screen that corresponds with the music that they're playing and timed to the music that they're playing. Mm. So it's a very different sort of brass organ.
Natural
concert.
Images?
Or I have not
are
seen
you that
the
far
images.
Yet? Yeah.
No. So I don't know what the images will be, but I hear that it's really going to be a fantastic concert.
And it will be, and I should have asked this about Charlie Brown, too, the performance space is in the sanctuary, or do you have a different space in the church?
There is a fellowship hall downstairs of the church that has a small stage, so we'll do You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
The Renati will be upstairs in the sanctuary. The following program, Sheila Murphy, will be upstairs in the sanctuary as well, as will the Haydn. Most of the productions are done in the actual sanctuary at the church.
Because they don't require the physical requirements of moving around.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't need the curtain.
I want to be a prima donna. Sheila Murphy is a graduate of IU. She teaches on the faculty of Western Florida University in Pensacola. How did you lure her back up to do this concert? What are her ties here?
Dr. Sheila Murphy has appeared with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra a few times.
Uh-huh.
She has sung with Jack Everly elsewhere as well. And she was in Yuletide Symphony, or Yuletide Celebration, excuse me, and met me through doing that. And so then met Jack Fox, and he said, oh, I would love for her to come and do a recital for us.
And talk about your singing relationship with the ISO.
I've appeared with Yuletide Celebration for the last 8 years and will be appearing again this year for the symphony.
Yeah. Back to Northwood for a moment. I teased you before we turned on the microphone about your June concert. with the title Hide and Seek, but it the point is to seek to discover what makes Haydn so popular, right?
Yes, yes, it is. There are going to be two pieces on that particular concert by Joseph Haydn. The first one is the Symphony No. 6, Le Matin. It's one of his small symphonies. Mm-hmm. It would be probably between around 15 players.
And again,
as part of the orchestra.
Pickup orchestra from around the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hired musicians. Mm-hmm. And then for the second piece, they're going to do the drum mass that Haydn wrote around the time that Napoleon was invading Austria. And that was sort of his response to Napoleon's invasion of Austria.
And this will feature your choir?
Yes, on the second piece, the drum mass.
Sharon Gamble with Rob Leffler. You can see A Good Man Charlie Brown this Saturday at Northwood Christian Church, 4550 Central Avenue. For more information about the musical and other offerings in their series, call Northwood at 317-283-1352. That's 317-283-1352. Let's hear a bit of music from You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown.
My stomach clock just went off. It's supper time and Charlie Brown has forgotten to feed me. Here I lie, a withering, hollow shell of a dog. And there sits my supper dish. Empty! But that's all right. He'll remember. When no furry friend comes to greet him after school, then he'll remember and he'll rush out here to the doghouse, but it'll be too late. There'll be nothing left but the dried carcass of the former friend who used to love to run and play so happily with him. Nothing but the bleached puppy bones.
Hey, Snoopy! Are you asleep or something? I've been standing here a whole minute with your supper.
Supper time? Supper time? Behold the brimming bowl of meat and meal, which is brought forth to ease our hunger. Behold the flowing flagon, moist and sweet, which has been sent to slake our thirst.
Okay, there's no need for a big production. Just get down off that doghouse and eat.
Supper time, very best time of day.
It's supper time.
Yeah.
It's supper time. And when supper time comes, can supper be far away? Bring on the soup dish. Bring on the cup. Bring on the bacon and fill me up.
Cause it's supper. Supper, supper, supper.
Place to go, a bedtime, overtime, halftime too, but they just can't hold a candle to my supper time. Oh yeah! Hello, home listeners, how are you? Bring on the hammer, bring on the bun. Happy's little puppy loves everyone.
Listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Shame is the subject matter and the title of the new musical created by some University of Indianapolis professors that they based on Nathaniel Hawthorne's classic novel, The Scarlet Letter. Theater professor Brad Wright wrote the book, and music professor Peach Buddy wrote the music and lyrics, all based on an original script by David Blomquist. Travis DiNicola spoke with Wright and Schmuddy about the new work.
I know you've been busy all summer working on this musical, the musical Shame, adapted from the story of Scarlet Letter. Gentlemen, I want to start with saying, you know, I recognize that, you know, not all musicals have to be frivolous, and certainly can deal with dramatics and serious subjects, but I was a little bit surprised when I heard, Brad, that you guys were going to be tackling Scarlet Letter as a musical.
Well, that's an excellent point. Actually, I'm going to defer to Pete because he's the one of the originators of this. I came on board a little bit later in the process. So,
Pete, how did this even start?
Well, how far back do we want to go? actually, we need to go back almost 25 years. At that time, I had a small production company. I had a partner. It was another composer. And we used to work on a lot of commercial projects, and we worked with one individual who was a writer. And after working so many projects for other clients and serving their desires, we said, you know, it'd be great if we did a musical.
Yeah,
let's put on a show.
Yeah.
And it was my partner at the time, Doug Binge, who actually came up with the idea. He said, I always thought it would be a good idea to do a musical adaptation of The Scarlet Letter.
Huh.
And the more we started to think about it, it's kind of everything you said. It's not a particularly uplifting show. You won't see any tap numbers in the show.
Well, that's what I was wondering. You know?
Yeah. Nothing like that. But
in many ways almost like a soap opera, in you know, with the stories that are intertwined and going on there. I mean, certainly in a much denser language than, you know, we're accustomed to today for some things, but.
Don't start talking about language, because I adapted the script from the novel for the book based on the original work that came from that previous iteration, and that's been one of the biggest challenges is adapting that language from Nathaniel Hawthorne. I'm sure many of your listeners have read that in high school or. We're told
tried to read
that in high school, exactly. Yeah. And so that's been one of the big challenges, is adapting that language into something that's alive and, you know, today.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dense is one word for
So what's the process like for this? I mean, certainly, or maybe let me go back to you, Pete, a little bit and just say, you know, when you first started thinking about this, Scarlet Letter, the musical, how did you envision it? Obviously, you didn't envision tap dancing. Okay, but in terms of, you know, the story itself or the production itself, what were you first thinking?
Well, actually, from a musical standpoint, and this was, I think, one of the fundamental problems we had with the first iteration, as Brad said, my partner Doug and I we just come from New York, where we had seen Dreamgirls.
Mm-hmm.
And Dreamgirls was one of the first musicals that actually took a more contemporary type of music and set that on the Broadway stage. So everything we wrote was basically R&B.
Well,
musically, you can imagine the problem we have, because the setting we still used. Puritan New England as the setting. The writer of the original script, David Blomquist, set it in Puritan New England, and with all the rhetoric and everything else, and then all of a sudden here comes this kind of R&B tune with a heavy backbeat.
And I'm just thinking, I mean, historically speaking, I don't remember a lot of, you know, R&B back then in Puritan England, or New England, but still, okay, I can sort of picture that.
Well,
okay.
But let me jump in here,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, please.
Picture any music. There was not a lot of smiling going on at that particular era, so I didn't have to worry about necessarily staying true to any particular musical period or style, but I have always seen it as exactly the way we're staging it now. It's not a modern adaptation of it. It's not set in present day. It's there. It's early 17th century.
And what is it about the story for you, Pete, that was so interesting?
I think the three main characters, I've always thought of this piece as being a piece about Hester Prynne, who is a woman caught up in her own circumstances and having to live with that burden in that society, that heavily oppressive society. Yet here's a woman who somehow rises above that, and even though she adapts to her surroundings, is very much her own woman. Yet at the same time, you have the two other characters, and they're almost, you know, an archetype. You have Reverend Dimmesdale, who is just almost spineless, consumed of his own guilt for his quote-unquote sin. And then you have Chillingworth, who, in addition to being an evil, creepy man, is is consumed by his vengeance. So we always think of Hester as being the one who really loses in this piece, and in truth, she's the only one who emerges victorious, as far as I'm concerned. So I've always liked it. It's a very empowering piece, not just for women, but for anybody who's in that situation that can rise above those things.
So, Brad, with such a classic story that, you know, you're looking at, and also the fact that you know, Pete had been working on this already for a while, and then how did you get it? You came into it actually in the spring, I believe, or?
Yeah, I came into it late in the process as we were looking for a musical to do. Our university does a major musical every other year. We were kind of kicking around ideas, and Pete's wife actually said, whatever happened to that musical that you guys were writing about, The Scarlet Letter? And so we did some readings at the university with our students and kind of got a sense of what it was. And then I came on board to flesh it out. Basically, the original piece was kind of a long one act, I would say. And so I took material from the entire novel, adapted that, kind of condensed it, and that's been that's been kind of my major task, has been trying to streamline and
Can you let us into a little bit of the process, maybe, of how you do that? I mean, you said earlier, we were talking about how the language is very dense, you know, and going through it, and, you know, I know that, you know, knowing you and how you work, I can imagine you wanting to try to maintain the integrity of the language.
Exactly.
But at the same time, I mean, you know, you are trying to make this a theatrical piece. I mean,
right.
You know,
that actors can actually speak.
Yeah.
And that's that. So basically, I sort of took the dialogue from the novel. Well, okay, there's not actually
a lot
of dialogue.
I imagine you're cutting a lot of things up physically and like putting it all over a big room. I don't know.
Yeah. There were post-it notes on a giant, giant whiteboard that's in my son's room right now. But I wanted to, like you said, maintain the integrity of the original, but make it alive and speakable by actors today. So basically took the material from the novel and sort of as my base, it was just, you know, these long rambling paragraphs from Hawthorne.
And with little dialogue, actually.
There's not a lot of dialogue, but what dialogue is there is paragraph. Mm. Like one sentence is an entire paragraph. And so I took those words, tried to find what the kernel of that moment was, express that using as much of the flavor of Hawthorne's language and cadence and so forth, contemporizing somewhat, but not completely modernizing. I mean, try to maintain that flavor of the puritanical language that Hawthorne was writing about, you know, after the fact. And it has been sort of an ongoing process of streamlining, cutting, shaping. And now it's gotten even more interesting now that we've been in rehearsal. The character of Pearl is being played by actually two separate 7-year-old girls. We cast two different actresses in that, in case somebody got chicken pox, or and there'll be alternating performances. But now to have the actual 7-year-old try to speak Pearl's lines, well, she can't actually say that word, so I have to find another word that has that same flavor. And
now that's got to be an interesting experience, because you know, as a director, I'm sure you know a lot of the time you're working with actors and you think, boy, I'd love to change some of the words in that script, right. You know, to help this along. But you really don't, or you really can't always do that. Mm-hmm. But here, you're the person who essentially wrote the script. And I don't know, is this sort of the first time that you've ever been involved in essentially directing something that you wrote?
Well, I'm not directing.
Or you're not directing.
I'm not okay. directing. Jen Alexander.
Jen Alexander's directing. Okay,
yes.
But you were there and able to make the adjustments
right.
for, you know, the lines. And so
right. I have not been actually sitting in on the rehearsals. I have to stay away and sort
is
of
that
get...
Better?
Yes. What are they doing to my words?
Fixing them.
Hey, wait a minute. Well, sometimes, yeah. But we had a read-through the other night, and it was, you know, there with my red pen making notes and tweaks. And so the cast has gotten a bunch of rewrites.
Yeah.
And frankly, that's one of the, I think, real benefits to our students. I mean, mm-hmm. this is, after all, a university production, and one of our main goals is to expose our students to, you know, a wide variety of experiences, and we've got both theater and music students. It's a co-production between the departments of music and theater, and we've also got students who are neither one of mm-hmm. those majors. And this experience of working on a new script where you are indeed learning your lines and learning your music and your lyrics, and all of a sudden you get handed a piece of paper that says, okay, scene 9 has been cut. Ah! You know,
I mean,
so
that's an unusual experience for any actor, much less a college
it
student.
It is, but I think one of the benefits is you get an opportunity to work that way. And quite frankly, a lot of our theater students, for instance, may be working on new scripts once they graduate. You know, they go to Chicago, mm-hmm. and there are, you know, several theaters that specialize in new scripts, and so they need actors for their readings. And so, if you have, you know, some experience or some, you know, a skill set with that kind of material, so
that's a great opportunity
yeah,
for your
think,
students.
Yeah,
yeah. Now, how do both of you, as far as working with the students? Recognizing you're not directing, as you mentioned, Jen Alexander is the director of Shame. But you know, how do you talk to the students about making this relevant today, relevant to them?
From my perspective, I take sort of a longer view of the script, and I'm looking at the sort of societal context
mm-hmm.
and the relevance to today, right? Today. Of the sort of puritanical atmosphere of the you know, Boston of that time, how does that speak to our contemporary situation? And there are two other important characters. One is the governor, and one is a reverend, and they sort of represent the religious and secular aspects of that society and the hypocrisy that they exhibit and that the people of that town exhibit towards Hester
mm-hmm.
That I think is at the core of the novel. That's something that I was really trying to bring out in this production. So there are characters in the musical that aren't actually in the novel. There are, for instance, there's a trio of women who don't actually appear in Hawthorne's novel, but as I was sort of trying to figure out how to manifest this, you know, hypocrisy or the sort of growth and movement that the people of Boston had towards Hester that needed to be embodied by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So I came up with these three women, and I said to Pete early on, I said, I think these three women are going to be a lot more important than I had originally anticipated. And so there are three individuals, and they each have an individual sort of take on Hester.
And did it function like a chorus? Or
I was not going to use that word so as not
well,
to...
I will then.
But I will let you. Because I don't want to confuse that with sort of a musical chorus
right,
where, you know,
sure.
it's the folks in the background singing. But it's almost like a Greek chorus.
Okay.
Where we see the interactions between these three women and Hester grow over the course of the... of the play.
And commenting and observing that action.
Exactly. And so early on, two out of the three are really against her. They want her to be branded and whipped and, you know, killed for her sin. And by the end, you know, they're singing about her as being a caring and sharing woman. And so I felt that I needed, you know, some embodiment of that.
Yeah.
And so... there are those elements of the novel that I was really trying to bring out, the kind of secular hypocrisy as well as the religious hypocrisy.
But I think you're right. The townspeople in the novel actually are almost a collective character
you're right.
in the play, and they evolve as well. And, yeah, the trio of women actually give a more individualized voice to what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask this one last question for you guys. So the play, the musical, Shame, is debuting at University of Indianapolis, but plans for afterwards yet?
Someone else asked me that earlier today, and I didn't have any answer because, quite frankly, I'm still trying to get to writing the double bar at the end of the score, which says we're finished. I don't know, and I don't even know have any idea of how to... promote it or pursue that. One thought we have had is that when it's all said and done, we will take the script complete with all the changes as they were the last night,
right.
get a clean one, and we'll do the same thing with the score.
Hmm.
So that somewhere, at least sitting on a shelf, will be, this is the state it was in when we finished with it.
Right.
And you can start and go from here.
Travis DiNicola with University of Indianapolis professors Brad Wright and Pete Schmutty. Their original musical, Shame, based on The Scarlet Letter, runs from October 22nd through the 30th in the Randsburg Auditorium at Esch Hall on the campus of the U of I. The musical is directed by Jen Alexander. For more information, visit theater.uindy.edu, and that's theater, T-H-E-A-T-R-E, so theater.uindy.edu, or call 317-788-3455, again, 317-788-3455. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I'll bet you wore yourself out getting all the gallery openings on First Friday last week. I know I did.
It was a great weekend.
It was amazing.
A lot of good stuff.
But we're here to remind folks that just because First Friday's over doesn't mean the art has gone away.
Oh, no, not at all.
Lots of things to see and do on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
What do you have?
Well, I know it seems awfully early to be talking about this.
No. Christmas Carol?
No. It's on along the same theme, though. Beef and Board's Dinner Theater is going to be presenting White Christmas, and it debuts October 14th and runs through November 21st. Nothing like a little White Christmas to get you in the mood.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Directed by Eddie Curry, it'll be a ton of fun. It's part of their dinner theater up there at Beef and Boards. But, it does open early this season.
Speaking of seasonal events, you can go see Cabaret Poe, which is a musical based on the works of Edgar Allan Poe. It's at the Lodge in Irvington. That's right at Washington Street and Johnson Avenue, and it runs for most of October. And go if you dare, because it's kind of creepy.
Whoa.
Yeah, exactly. You do that better than anybody I know.
Oh, thanks. Well, it is that creepy time of year with Halloween that is coming up. And Ghost Tales of the Witch and Famous.
Love that title.
Love the title. Is taking place over at the Harrison home. Haunting Tales of the Well-to-Do and the Wickedest Witches Told in the Stately Rooms of the Harrison Home, and this starts on October. Starting on October 15th, running through the 24th, Friday, Saturday, Sundays. Lots of performances each evening and afternoon. Really fun for kids. Not recommended for under six, but definitely for older kids. And you'll have a great time over at the President Benjamin Harrison Home. And after your performance, you can have like some kettle corn and all types of fun stuff.
Mm.
Check them out for more information.
speaking of older kids, an exhibit that opened, kicking off last first Friday, is up through October 29th, and it's Voices, Women of a Certain Age. It's an all-female show at the Stutz Art Space Gallery, all different sorts of artwork, and you can go over there Monday through Friday from 11 to 2. Great thing to do on your lunch hour. Look at some art, maybe even shop for some art.
Oh, sounds delightful. Mm-hmm. Hey, this weekend is the opening of the classical series for the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and they are starting off with the violinist Midori, who actually debuted with the orchestra in 1985 at the age of 14. And so he has come back and will be playing.
Oh, she.
She.
Yeah.
Damn, I knew that. I remember I did that once before. In 3, 2, 1. So she has come back and will play in with them all weekend long to kick off their classical series.
In the creepy city streets of Skeletown. Thank you, right on cue. You will find a maze of skeletons, and you can go through various venues, through the Bone Crusher Stadium, an Artrocious Museum, the Heartless Hotel, the Indiana State Scaregrounds, the Zombie Zoo, the Spine-Chilling Speedway, and, as they say, many, many more. Where can you do all of this? At the spooktacular event of the year at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. It's their annual haunted house, and this year's theme is Skeletown.
We have to start thinking, Sharon, about what we're going to dress up as
I
this
know,
year.
I know.
Hey, last thing I have that I want to mention is actually two things that the Cabaret is putting on. This is the Cabaret at the Columbia Club. One of them is a concert with Jennifer Lee Warren, known as the original Alice's Daughter from the Tony Award-winning show Big River, and also Crystal from Little Shop of Horrors. She's going to be playing, performing on Friday, October 15th and also the 16th at Cabaret at the Columbia Club. Great cabaret show. But also the Cabaret is putting on an event with Howard Caldwell. He was on Art of the Matter just a couple weeks ago.
I really enjoyed that conversation about classic theater.
Yeah, he'll be talking about his book and signing copies of his book, The Golden Age of Indianapolis Theaters. And this is taking place on Tuesday, October 12th, with a meet-and-greet program starting at 5:30. And then he'll be talking to him questions and answers. And this is free at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club.
Free is good.
Free is great.
And last thing I have, on Monday, this coming Monday, the 11th, at the DeHaan Fine Arts Center at 7:30, you can hear the Indianapolis Baroque Orchestra, joined by the IU Jacobs School of Music Pro Arte Singers, in a concert called The Saxon and the Priest. And if you heard our broadcast from Penrod, you know who the Saxon was and who the priest was. They are references to two Baroque composers.
Whoa.
I'm not going to tell you.
Nothing scary.
No,
all
no,
about
they're
that.
Not scary. Okay. It's okay.
Okay. Well, we'll be back with more things scary and not so scary next week on that calendar we call
What Will We Do? Will it be candy corn?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Clues Memorial Hall at Butler University is hosting an exhibition of art created by a variety of visual artists associated with the school. From October 12th through October 24th, you can see the exhibit called Butler Creates. And James Kramer, who works at Clues but is also an artist represented, came in to tell Sharon more about the exhibit.
Okay, normally when people are headed to Clues Memorial Hall on the campus of Butler University, they are there for a concert or a lecture or a dance performance or you name it. But there's programming in the lobby. There's programming throughout the building. And one of the programs we want to talk about today is called Butler Creates. Where did this idea come from?
Well, it came from the new Art Plus Design program that mm-hmm. Butler has launched this fall. In anticipation of that, about a year ago, we started speaking with the director of that program, Gautam Rao. And because we have the Art at Clues program, which really provides an opportunity for Hoosier artists to display their work there and to be seen, and as well as to see other artists, it seemed like a logical fit.
We, you know, I try to program as much in advance as possible, so we already had this year booked.
Mm-hmm.
But as it turned out, I was able to shave a week off of one artist and at the end of theirs and at the beginning of the next, and we were able to squeak out 2 weeks of alumni show, which is what this is. Butler Creates is a show for our Butler alums, and we're having 25 of them that will be displaying works there. Now, the Art Plus Design program is new, so these alums are those that have come through other majors but now are creating art, so that their experience at Butler wasn't directly related to an art program per se, but they are creating art. And so we think it's a great way to connect that, and at the same time there will be a student work around the campus as well. And it'll all culminate then with Homecoming Weekend, where we'll have a gallery tour. Actually, we're going to have the artists there. Several of them are going to be coming in from out of town. We have 9 different states around the country that are represented. So we have several of the artists that will be there and available to talk with the public. And then it will be a 3 o'clock concert on that day. This is Sunday, the 24th of October, and at 1:30 we'll have the space open so that patrons can come in and enjoy that. And then, as I say, there's a free concert afterwards, so we encourage people to stay for that.
Butler Symphony Concert?
It is. It's actually an honor roll of choirs that day. And then the exhibit comes down. At the end of the day, we'll take the work down, and the artists will take it and take it home. So,
unless they've found a buyer.
Well, that's entirely true too. That was one of those things that we talked about. And back to your point of how long this has been going. You know, we were working on this about a year ago, and we've been continuing to send out submissions, receive the work in, go through a juried panel to select the works that were going to be in the show, that we would like to be in the show, and then we send it back to those artists. And as I say, we actually accepted more works than what are going to be coming, because some of them just found it was going to be too much of logistics and, you know, in trying to ship their work here and things like that was going to be a little prohibitive for them. So, but we still, as I say, have a nice representation of states represented from the breadth of where our alums have gone.
And breadth of media as well.
Yes, absolutely. We do have a variety of things. We have mixed media, we have acrylic, photographs.
Costume design. Costumes, we can mention that,
yes.
Because you have a grouping of costumes in the show.
I do. These are costumes that I've designed and have used in productions and various...
Theater or dance?
Theatrical dance,
yeah.
Also for Epiphany. So there are some Magi costumes as well. So they're really quite lush and lovely and a little bit different. And even the dance pieces have much more of an Asian feel about it. They have a lot more flow to them than a traditional leotard and type of costume might have. So that'll be nice to see that collection together.
So you've put your hands from the theater's costume department, put your hands on some mannequins, I'm guessing, as a way to display these.
I'm still working on that, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I have several things in mind. We, you know, we thought about just trying to bring a dimensional aspect to it. So that was one of those pieces because everything else will probably be on the wall.
Yeah.
They're fairly traditional needlepoint work, painted pieces, variety of fiber arts and things. So most of those will be hanging, and then to have something that was going to bring some dimensional work in there, we thought would just be a nice complement. It remains to be seen, though, how we're actually going to use that, because that is a new element for us. Because hall is, as we said, basically it's used for performances.
Sure.
Access, egress are very important. So we have to be very careful with what we have in the hall that not only is tasteful and thought-provoking but not offensive, but we also have to have it in a safe location so that not only the patron's safety as they're in the hall, but in case of an emergency,
sure,
we want to make sure that no exit is blocked. So we have been very cautious in having dimensional pieces in there because there are just a very few corners of that building that would accommodate that and not be in the flow of traffic. So that presented its own little challenge. But the fact that we have such a large amount of wall space really puts us in a very unique position, I think, in town to have a large group show.
Feelings, yeah.
And it's just wonderful, wonderful space for the artists to create in. We've had so many artists now over the years that with our Art at Clues program, and we have this kind of either solo or maybe duo shows. Sometimes we'll do the group show like we're doing now.
Sometimes themed to coincide with something mm-hmm. that's going on performance-wise.
Yes, yes. So it varies, but it has been going on for years now, and it's just very successful, and we've had just great response. And again, from a variety of artists all over the state. And one thing that we'll be doing in this group show model will be in the spring, Scholastic Art and Writing Awards will be there in a group show. That's where we have Central and Southern Indiana 7th through 12th graders creating work. And the connection there is that is the next generation of artists. They could be students that come to Butler for this Art Plus Design program. They could be our future alums. They definitely are the next generation of artists, and we feel that's very important to feature their work, to show that work. And that program came about much like this, that someone had an idea. We have a show. We'd like to have a place to hang it. Where's the biggest and best place to have it
yeah.
That we can have right here on campus? And it was in the hall. So,
you mentioned mm-hmm. before we turned the microphones on that you had, this summer, you'd had all the artwork off the walls
yes.
for some maintenance and some repairs and
mm-hmm.
so forth. And,
yes.
and you realized how bare it looked.
It did. It was necessary. We had some plaster work that needed to be touched up. We had some painting, those kinds of things. And that happens periodically. You know, you have to just, and we haven't for years. We've been having it year round with only a turnover between exhibitions. So this was the time that we really took summertime. Let's get in, do some deep cleaning, deep painting and that sort of thing. But it really did feel very bare. And that's the way the hall was for about 35 years, that there was no art.
That was part of the original concept
mm-hmm.
because it
mm-hmm.
was a time when, let me say this diplomatically, architecture was meant to show off its own materials,
mm-hmm.
let's call it,
mm-hmm.
and it was a particular style of within the broad category of modernism, and
mm-hmm.
So there was a little evolution in there somewhere.
Yeah, it was. Years ago, you know, we were working with the Stutz on their spring show, and we wanted to sell tickets at the box office, and we did a little exchange. We said, well, let's have some of your work here. We'll do the box office work. And so we ended up having some lovely visual art. And we really think it complements. It fully rounds out. You know, as we said, it's a performing arts venue when you get into the auditorium onto the stage, but there's so much more for the patrons to come and experience there. Clearly, most patrons arrive well enough before the show so that they can have a conversation, they can feel the sense of community there, they're sharing this evening or this experience with others, and to have visual art there just really helps support that and really surrounds the patrons with art. And I think it really has helped the gallery scene here in Indianapolis, because we have created, we've basically brought the space to the patrons. Where few patrons may go to a gallery, if we bring the art to them, they may feel now more comfortable to go, because
mm-hmm.
they've jumped over that hurdle that says, you know, if I go, I'm going to feel obligated to buy, or I'm going to feel like somebody's going to be, you know, those kinds of things that, you know, we've made it very easy in that sense, and not in any way diminished it, but actually I think enhanced that, that there is an art scene here, that there is something that patrons should really look deeper into the Indianapolis wealth of artistic talent.
You know, I'm struck by, first of all, the fact that you found 25 artists, because while Jordan College of Fine Arts is world-renowned for dance, for theater, certainly for music, it has a very short history of visual. I mean, Gautam has been there with you 3-4 years,
mm-hmm,
maybe?
Yes, yes.
So the Art Plus Design program is fairly new.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in among your artists, you have, I don't know if she's a pharmacist or not, but she graduated from the
mm-hmm.
College
mm-hmm.
of Pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
You have people who went through the program to become educators, people in fine arts, people in liberal arts and sciences, people in the business program. How did you put out the call for submissions?
Well, certainly electronically,
yeah.
Through the alumni magazine.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, there was some direct contact. Some people, you know, were just a word of mouth.
Yeah.
So a variety of ways. And again, I think this will draw more, we're expecting more response in the future. And, you know, I guess I'll be going on the air here.
Will this be an annual?
That's, I was just, it, certainly we're looking for next year. I think it's a wonderful way to serve many artists at once. You
sure.
know, we can have a lot of solo exhibitions in the hall, and some artists are ready for that. They have a volume of work. Their quality is ready to show, a solo show. But to have a group show like this really gives us an opportunity to serve so many more of our artists, and in this case, our alums.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really important, and to be able to show a real range of art, and for our patrons to be able to see that art is more than just a photograph or a painting, that there is, and within those, what the range is. So I think it's extremely exciting possibilities for future, certainly next year. You know, I'm looking at it being a longer than 2-week time period. And again, along that line, just as far as for folks who'd want to come and see the exhibition, we are open 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, regular business hours. We have a variety of things that will be going on in the hall, so if people are concerned, they can certainly call ahead to make sure that, you know, that everything's clear. If you have large groups that they're wanting to bring, we certainly would appreciate a little heads up, because we do have some daytime performances that are going on during those 2 weeks. You know, that we have those, anything that's in the evening, any performances that are going on then, the space is open and available. Certainly then that concert that follows that gallery tour will be, another of those opportunities for folks to come and see and enjoy that.
Sharon Gamble with James Kramer, Community Relations Manager for Clues Memorial Hall of Butler University. You can see James's costumes, plus lots more work by Butler artists at Clues from October 12th through October 24th. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll take some steps to learn about contradancing.
I'll find out how Big Car Gallery is bringing art experiences to local neighborhoods.
And I'll take a look at Rusty Moe's book, Bright Wild Stone. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.